Hi everyone. This podcast is about regenerative movements, and as a guest we were honored to have Carl Tiedemann from the US. Carl became aware of environmental issues from a young age and started studying chemistry with the hope of starting to do some environmental work. He understood that the climate crisis was not something that is in the future, and that it in fact is happening right now. He also realized that the crisis meant that we had to begin very aggressively remove the excess carbon dioxide from the air. Through his work, he began to understand that photosynthesis was truly the only practical and feasible option at scale, and therefore he founded Soil for Climate to do exactly that. Soil for Climate was founded in 2015 by Carl and his friend Seth Itzkan. They chose to create Soil for Climate as a non-profit organization, as it meant greater flexibility for them on their mission. This also meant that they did not have any burden in terms of profit or income. Carl thinks that one of the greatest roles that Soil for Climate has had is the Facebook community that has been built. It has members from all over the world, or more precisely from over 100 different countries, and it just hit over 28,000 members. In this community, new articles, research, innovative practices, and questions can be shared. Soil for Climate hopes that they can share this knowledge and awareness of regenerative practices through this community, and also on other social media platforms. Soil for Climate also tracks legislation on a state and federal level, and they go on meetings with different influential people, such as staffs of presidential candidates, to give updates on the sciences around regenerative agriculture. Carl also mentioned that they have done some testimony at different hearings. In this podcast, you will hear more about how regenerative practices works and how Carl sees regenerative soil as a solution to our climate crisis.
Regenerative grazing is a concept that Carl brought up during the interview. This is also a concept that we have talked about during the course. For example, we had a guest lecture held by Judith Swartz, a journalist and author who has written a lot about regenerative approaches. She presented pictures and told fascinating stories that showed how regenerative grazing is a better way to approach grazing, as it so clearly helps the environment in many different ways. Swartz also talks about regenerative agriculture and grazing in her book, The Reindeer Chronicles, and other inspiring stories of working with nature to heal the earth. She also talks about soil specifically in connection with regenerative grazing, which fits well with our podcast and the interview with Carl. According to her, an arid piece of land can be improved through holistic plant grazing. Next, you will hear some of Carl's thoughts on what regenerative soil is.
The goal of regenerative agriculture is farming in the way that nature would do it. So for example, whenever you go out into nature, anytime you see soil, it's covered by living plants. You would just never see bare soil, except in the case of a landslide or some sort of catastrophic experience. Nature seeks to fill a vacuum, and with regard to soil, soil wants to have plants growing on it. So one of the first rules in regenerative agriculture is to keep the soil covered as much of the year as possible. Typically, we would see vast areas of the United States left fallow, left bare, during the time when there were no crops growing. And the thought, going back even to passages in the Bible and so forth, it would say that it's important to leave your land fallow, you know, or bare, you know, one in every 7 years or so forth. But as one microbiologist explained to me when we saw a field that was bare, he said, you know, that field isn't resting, it's dying. And the fact is, when you have bare soil and it's exposed to the ultraviolet rays of sunlight, the UV rays are actually oxidizing organic molecules on the surface. So just simply leaving soil exposed is guaranteeing that you have carbon dioxide emissions from it. It's important to disturb the soil as little as possible. If you see a field that has been freshly plowed, it is billowing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Of course, you cannot see it, but it's the same as a smokestack at a coal burning facility, massive amounts of carbon dioxide. There is an author William Ruddiman, back in 2005, he had an article in Scientific American magazine asking, when did anthropogenic climate change begin? Very often we hear it was in the 1850s or so when coal and oil first began to be exploited, you know, at a large scale. But in fact, he pegs the date at about 10,000 years ago at the dawn of agriculture, when humans, although we were relatively small in numbers, began to disturb the environment at a very large scale through the use of fire, burning, deforestation, plowing, and mismanaged grazing. David Montgomery, who is a geomorphologist at the University of Washington, wrote a terrific book called Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, which came out, I believe, around 2005, 2006. And he looked at approximately 20 civilizations throughout history and why they had failed. And he began to understand that all of them had a lifespan of approximately 500 years. And because of his work on agriculture, he began to understand that when you plow a field year after year after year, you lose a certain amount of soil every time, that typically you could get roughly 500 years worth of plowing before essentially the soil was gone. And he understood that these civilizations collapsed because of the agricultural practices that were being used. They degraded the soil to the point where they could no longer feed their populations. Now, what does it mean to degrade soil? Healthy soil, you know it when you see it. You know, you scoop it up in your hands, you can smell it, it's a dark color. Sometimes it's described as having a chocolate cake type of texture, you know, it can clump together well. And that soil is full of life. Another way of saying it is that it's very high in organic matter. As you degrade soil by plowing or applying chemicals to it, pesticides, synthetic fertilizers, and so on, the soil begins to degrade to the point where it ends up looking like sand. So sand, highly degraded soil, is almost indistinguishable from sand, has very little organic matter. And as a result, many farms, including here in the US and throughout the world now, farmers are basically farming on dead soil or soil that is nearly dead. And consequently, they need to use the synthetic fertilizer because all of the natural fertility in the soil is gone. There is an expression that, you know, fertilizer is good for the parent, but bad for the child. So when you first begin to use it, you do get the green flush and everyone's excited. Oh, you know, we're getting better crops and more crops and so on. But over time, the synthetic fertilizers and the pesticides, destroy soil life and take their toll on them. So anyway, the principles are disturbing the soil as little as possible. So many farmers are now practicing what they call no-till. Till is another word for plowing, or absolutely minimal till, doing just a very light amount of sort of scratching the surface rather than overturning, you know, a 30 centimeter, you know, amount of depth or so forth. So keeping the soil covered, disturbing it as little as possible, using variety. In nature, you would never go out and just see a field of just one type of flower. Typically, there would be hundreds of different types of plants. Why is this important? It turns out that through photosynthesis, whenever the sun is shining on a plant, the plant is making sugars. And the sugars, some of them the plant uses to build the stalk and the stems and leaves, the actual structure of the plant. But many of these sugars, the plant is pumping out through its roots into the ground, into the soil. And why would a plant give away this photosynthetic energy? It's doing it to feed life in the soil, the bacteria and the fungi, so that the soil life can then in turn give back to the plant the nutrition and the minerals that it needs. So for example, plants need minerals, as do humans and animals and so forth, iron and copper and boron and selenium and zinc and so forth. But it turns out that roots of a plant cannot on their own extract minerals from the soil. So how does it get the minerals? Bacteria can't produce them, but fungi that live in the soil can produce acids and enzymes that can go out and chemically etch rocks to get exactly the minerals that are needed by the plant and all of the other soil life. So in order to have a healthy, thriving agricultural system that requires no synthetic inputs, you need to have healthy fungi in order to get the minerals that the plant needs. Well, it turns out that each type of plant feeds a certain microbial community in the ground. The plants are sending down thousands of compounds that are that certain types of bacteria and fungi respond to as food. So each type of plant makes its own unique blend. So in order to have diversity and health in the soil, you need to have as many different types of plants as possible, each of them feeding these underground communities. Now, I should mention when Dr. Christine Jones, who's a soil ecologist from Australia, she's done a lot of the pioneering work research on this field. She's coined the name the liquid carbon pathway to describe how the plant is pumping this liquid carbon into the ground. And back in the 1970s, there was a professor at Harvard, Dr. Woody Hastings, who I had the great honor of meeting about 10 years ago, not long before he passed away. And Woody Hastings and his team became most famous for their work on circadian rhythm, that is linking animal and human behavior to the cycles of sunlight and so forth. But another focus of their work was on something that has come to be called quorum sensing. So because you have a business background, you're probably familiar with the term quorum, that if you're going to have a business meeting, a board of directors or so forth, there need to be a certain percentage of the directors there, maybe 75 or 80% before to constitute a quorum. In other words, before you can actually go ahead and make a decision. So it was known back in the 1970s, or it was discovered, that if you took bioluminescent bacteria from the ocean, and if you put just a few of them into a test tube, they would not glow. And it's like, well, why not? You know, but sure enough, as more bacteria were added into the test tube, suddenly they would switch on and they would all begin glowing. So this phenomenon was called quorum sensing because there needed to be apparently a certain number or a certain critical mass or concentration in order for this behavior to express itself. Well, it was soon discovered that it wasn't just this one particular type of bacteria that acted in this way, but that all bacteria communicated in this way. And that the more different types of bacteria that you could bring together, the more different properties would begin to emerge, that by studying any of these bacteria in isolation, you would never learn or never discover. It was only as part of community dynamics. So this is all a long way of saying that we need to have diversity. If we give diversity to a system, nature can figure out exactly what is needed. And the more diversity it has to work with, the more resilient it can be, the faster it can heal, and so forth. I'd like to give one other example and return to the work of ecological engineer John Todd, who I mentioned earlier. When he was developing his concept for this biological treatment of wastewater, he had his graduate students go out to as many different ecosystems, the forest, the beach, the grasslands, the wetlands, and so forth, and collect soil samples from all of them. He then put all these soil samples into a large container and mixed them all up together. So it had as much diversity as you can imagine in this sample. He then had approximately 20 different glass or translucent, I don't know if they were glass, but tanks lined up. And he put some of this soil mixture into each one of these 20 different tanks. Into the first tank, he then introduced sewage water. Some of the bacteria that were present saw what was coming in as food and began to eat it up. Then, after settling there for few hours or a day or so, the water was then, the slightly treated water was then pumped into the second tank. In this second tank, some of the bacteria saw what was coming in as food, and they began to eat up this new mixture. After a day or so, the water was then put into the third tank, where again, a different group of bacteria saw what was coming in as food, and they began to go to work and eat it, and so forth, all the way down the line. So in each one of these 20 tanks, there were different biological processes and communities at work. It's nothing that any human could ever think, because there are millions of life forms. You can never predict in advance, well, which ones are going to respond and so forth. But finally, after tank number 20, out comes pure drinking water. So simply by providing the diversity to the system, nature was able to figure out exactly what it needed in order for this biological process to take place. So we see this now in farming. There are many farmers that are using, you know, not just one or two different cover crops, but instead they're using mixtures of dozens and dozens of different types of plants, all of which are, again, feeding the microbial life and allowing the soil health to improve as quickly as possible. So diversity, keeping soil covered, tilling as little as possible. We now know that even in a cropping system, you can improve soil health year on year, even while you're growing plants. A grazing system, a pasture that's well managed, is always better for the environment, because no matter how good a cropping system is, the farmer is always going to need to control the mouse population and the bird population and deer, because you don't want all these other animals eating your crops. And if they're healthy and tasty, then you're going to have even more of a problem, because that's where the animals are going to want to come to. In a grazing situation or a pasture situation that is well managed, it is completely compatible with wildlife. And this is something that it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around, because they think that grazing necessarily means exclusion of wildlife, but that's not true at all. In a well-managed grazing situation, you will have your herd of animals on a patch of ground, perhaps one or two days out of the year, with the other, you know, 51 and a half weeks available for the deer that want to come in, or the other wildlife. And in a pasture, you can have frogs and snakes and birds completely coexisting with the grazing animals. But it is crucial for the grazing to be managed properly, because when it's not, tremendous harm has been done and continues to be done all over the world.
We also discussed the differences between organic and regenerative farming. In the discussion, Carl came to explain that someone he knows was complaining about the performance of his organic farm. This may seem surprising, because we may reflexively talk about organic farms as a final solution to the problems caused by chemical farms, without thinking about regenerative theories. This may be true in some cases, but it's more complicated than that, and organic and regenerative farming may have different results.
Organic is a proscriptive a process. So in other words, organic legislation here, at least in the US, I presume it works the same in Europe, I don't know. But it essentially saying, with organic, you can't use this, you can't use that, you can't use this chemical, you can't use that chemical, you know, and so forth. And these are the chemicals that you are allowed to use. With regenerative, the focus is on improving soil health. So there are some regenerative farmers, frankly, who still use small amounts of herbicide to control, you know, weeds. For example, Gabe Brown, in an interview I saw him give, I guess about a year or so ago, he explained that he's not a purist. You know, I mean, he still uses a very small amount of herbicides when his neighbors complain about the weeds, for example, growing along the driveway. But his total chemical bill for that year was about $20. You know, for a spray can or two. You know, so absolutely minimal use of it. I think. The more farms become regenerative, the less need there is for these chemicals. And you cannot just go overnight. Typically, there needs to be a 3 or 4 year transition where you apply a little bit less nitrogen fertilizer every year as your soil health improves. If you just stop spraying it cold turkey, the land will die. There's an example here of a farmer in Vermont where I am named Jesse McDougall. And back, I'm going to guess about eight years or so ago, his wife's aunt who owned this farm passed away quite suddenly and unexpectedly. And the option was either for Jesse and his wife to take on this farm or it was going to have to be sold. And the problem is that neither Jesse nor his wife had any practical farming experience. What they did know is that they were planning on starting a family and they did not want to have their children exposed to all of these different farm chemicals and so on. So in their naivete, they just stopped spraying any fertilizer, and to their horror, nothing grew. You know, the land that had typically been providing, you know, hay and grass and so forth, you know, was beginning to look like a desert, you know, just bare land. And they panicked. They're like, well, what do we do now? How do we bring this land back to life? And it was late one night, as Jesse was going through different videos on YouTube, he found Alan Savory's TED Talk. And he began to see that what they needed to do was to introduce animals to bring the life back onto the land. So immediately they went out, started with chickens and then pigs. And within a few months, they began to see the grasses growing again, the soil health improving. And today he runs a very successful regenerative farm where, again, he's not using any chemical inputs. He uses sheep to provide the fertility. He'll rotate them in with his cropland. And he has a very successful operation today.
Based on our discussion with Carl, we got the impression that it would be easier for smaller farms to be regenerative in their practices. In other words, individual farmers could simply be mindful of how they farm and of the products they use while doing it. Meanwhile, intuitively, it seems like it would be more challenging for larger farms with obviously more land, but also as they still might have the same demands for efficiency and quality as anyone else. So we asked Carl for his opinion on how larger farms should approach the matter of being regenerative and sustainable. He argued that it shouldn't really matter whether the farm is small or large, as we should simply let nature do its thing. Okay, so let's hear what Carl had to say about this.
First of all, plants can become so healthy that they can become completely immune to disease and insects. He gives the example, there was a situation in, I don't know the specifics, but someplace in Africa, you know, where locust swarms had come in and they devastated all of the surrounding crop fields except for one farm where they left the crops alone. Why? Because the plants were so healthy that they were able to actively fight off the insects through toxins that the plants themselves make and so forth. So what is the solution to insecticides and herbicides? Is it more different ones, you know, that we need to keep evolving because, you know, nature keeps finding ways around them? No, it's to make the plants so healthy that they're not needed in the first place. One of the points that John made that blew my mind, frankly, he said that insects, you know, who farmers see as pests coming in trying to destroy their crops. No. The role of insects is to remove from the food supply any plants so low in nutritional value, they should not be consumed by humans or animals. So that when we have these weak, sickly plants growing, the insects are coming in to do us a favor of getting rid of them so that we don't eat them by mistake and think that we're getting nutrition when in fact we're not. So, you know, the traditional mindset, again, the industrial mindset, insects coming in, what do? Well, we kill the insects. Instead, let's look at why they're coming in and what can be done to discourage them and go eat the neighbor's crops instead, you know? Anyway, in grazing situations, I know of farms as large as 500,000 acres or larger. It's much easier to manage animals over a very large scale. Traditionally, for example, Soil for Climate works with a herding community in Kenya. And typically there, the herders, often teenage boys, will stay with the animals all day, all night, and so on. So it tends to be a pretty labor-intensive process. Here in the US, typically electric fencing technology is used. So just a couple of strands that can be taken down and repositioned literally within a matter of minutes. It's a very simple process. So you can determine where you want to have your animals. It's very important. Here's another point, relative to overgrazing. Most people who use the term overgrazing do not understand what the word means. Typically, overgrazing, they think, means that there are too many animals, but that's not true at all. Overgrazing is a function of time rather than numbers. What do I mean? When animals graze a plant, the plant, about 3 days later, begins to send up new leaves and new shoots, tender new shoots. If the animals are allowed to have access to that piece of land for longer than 3 days, they will come back and they will graze that plant a second time because they love those tender new shoots. In turn, that will stunt the plant growth because the plant says, oh gosh, geez, I was just trying to grow back and now I have to grow back again. So again, it sends up new leaves. And again, the cow comes over and chomps on that plant and plant's like, oh my God, I got to grow some more. And so it saps the energy of the plant. What you want to do is to prevent overgrazing by moving the animals at least every 3 days to a new pasture. That's what prevents overgrazing. So it doesn't matter. You can have 1,000 cows in an acre and they will not do overgrazing. You can have any number of animals. It doesn't matter. And the plant will not be overgrazed if the animals are there for no more than a couple of days. If you have too many animals, what will happen is the animal performance will begin to suffer because the animals won't be getting enough food and so forth. So that, of course, has to be taken into consideration, but it will not hurt the plant. You know, every day, it seems, you know, we see these tragic stories of flooding all over the world. And when you see the photos, you notice the flood water, inevitably it's brown and muddy. Well, why is that? It's because of soil degradation upstream. Instead of absorbing the water, it's pooling and flooding off and causing massive harm and erosion and loss of life and so forth. And when you see pictures like that or video, you know, the commentary is often, oh, you know, climate change and we have to cut fossil fuels. And well, yes, we do have to cut fossil fuels, but we can stop all fossil fuels tomorrow and it's not going to stop this massive flooding. How do you heal? How do you stop flooding? It's by healing land. So when you have cows on a landscape, streams and rivers that have been dried up for decades begin to come back to flow. So with proper grazing, it rehydrates the landscape. It is adding water to a landscape. You know, when a cow drinks water, it doesn't, not like a fossil fuel being burned, the water isn't gone forever. Instead, it's returned to the soil, value added with the nitrogen added into it, providing moisture in dry parts of the world. You know, the cows play this absolutely vital function. And then of course the water goes back into the hydrological cycle where it evaporates and comes back down as rain and so forth. So as we think about regeneration, we need to kind of lose our preconception of these conventional industrial models where it's not a zero sum game. You know, with regenerative agriculture, 1 + 1 can equal 3 or 4 or 5, you know, and that's how we need to heal the land.
We want to thank Carl for a highly informative and thought-provoking interview. We could see how passionate he was about the subject, and his knowledge and enthusiasm gave a nice touch of originality to this podcast. Finally, Carl and Soil for Climate puts an emphasis on art in their projects, especially music and poetry. As Carl is also a poet, we thought, what better way is there to end this podcast than with one of his poems?
So, what's the future? Is there no hope? Healing the land can help us cope and grow better food with less flooding too. Put carbon in soil is what we must do. Draw down the heat, slow the sea rise, let birds and bees thrive in the skies. Good farming is how we deal with this mess. Now the climate's fixed, what's next to address?